So we're still at this point of saying, for a generic system, how do we build a quantum computer? And we've got the piece that says, for one qubit, we know how to control it. We know how to characterize some of the major features of it. There's still a few things left, but I won't write the block equations on the board again. You've got those. And then we could go through David DiVincenzo's list and also Dan Gottesman's list, and we could say, well, what do we need for a quantum computer? What do we need for fault tolerance? And as I put the requirements on the board then, those requirements speak to what you need for a general purpose quantum computer. There was a question after class that said, do I need a general purpose quantum computer? And of course, you know, sitting at the Perimeter Institute, our goal might be not to break RSA encryption. I don't think it is. It might be to simulate quantum materials or other things. In which case, we don't need universal control. We need the control that allows us to write that Hamiltonian over our processor. And that Hamiltonian is likely to be translationally invariant. And so it's, you know, you may not have to have all of the control at the qubit level, and you certainly, you likely don't have to be able to individually address every qubit. You still need to worry, and it's a tricky thing of saying, what is an interesting measurement in these pieces? And it's worthwhile remembering that although trivially we can say, oh, if I run a quantum simulation on a quantum computer, I don't need as much memory space as if I did the same thing on a classical computer. That's of course true. But if it fits on a classical computer and you ran the simulation on a classical computer, then at some instant in time, if you just integrated Schrodinger's equation, you would have the full state of the system. And since it's sitting there in silico, you can then go and you can interrogate it over and over and over and over again, and you can learn anything about it. And of course, if you run a quantum computer, you have a state stored in a set of qubits, and you can make a set of complementary measurements, but then you're bloody out of luck and you should do something again. And of course, you also, if you have a system which is a microscopic quantum computer, so that it's one copy of the system, then of course you get one measurement. You don't get an expectation value out of this. And so the question of saying, oh, we can more profitably explore physics on a quantum simulator, seems that it must be true, because if we had a quantum simulator, we could do things which we certainly can't do on a classical computer. But to close that story of saying, this is what you should be doing, okay, I don't think we've quite closed that chapter on that. So we still need to do a bit more there. And as we were looking, we wanted to say, well, what are some of the hard things? And so the hard pieces, and I'm just going to take David's and Dan's ideas and put them together and extract what I think are the hard pieces. So low error is when you have noise. Even for one qubit, it's not clear that we've actually solved that problem, and that's the easiest of those. So we'll look at that a little bit. I told you that getting universal control was easy. But it hides the fact that achieving high fidelity gates that give you universal control is not easy. And so you'll find many systems where if I want to do a single qubit rotation, I can do it well. But a two-qubit conditional gate is hard. And there's some systems where it's vice versa, that the two-qubit is easy, but the single qubit is hard. And of course, you need you need one experimental configuration that does it all. And we tend to show you that, oh, if I go over to this experimental apparatus, you know, you were in my lab, so you saw, we have lots of experimental apparatuses. I can say, oh, I can go over here, and I can do this really, really well, right? I can go back to the silicon lab. If you want one qubit gates, we can knock your socks off. And then I can go over to another lab and say, oh, this piece I can do well. And then I can combine those and forget to tell you that they're incompatible experiments. Yeah?
I mean, if I have, you know, kind of some basis set that doesn't, you know, it generates every universal gate, like the infinite limit of repeating them, that, I mean, how does a Q factor scale it to apply, like, repeated gates? Or if that's the right term.
So, clearly, to get universal control, all we need to do is to say, let's look at the commutators of all of our generators. And provided that they form a closed set that spans the system we want, we're good. And I tend, though others won't, to think in terms of the Hamiltonian, because those are the knobs we actually have in the lab. Others will think in terms of gates. But of course, you know, the gates are some integrated action over some time-varying Hamiltonians. And then you say, well, okay, are some gate sets better than others? If I'm forced to expand the Hilbert space and then contract it again, which for many protocols we do, we go out of the Hilbert space to do a gate, then we come back in. Is that as good as if I just did the gate directly? And I think that the answer is, if you look at the action of the total integrated gate, that's all you need. Now, you do have to remember that we said that correlated errors are deadly. And I didn't say it, but maybe I should have, that leaving echoes of what you do in the environment is deadly. So if you leave behind a signature of your processor in the environment, then of course you shouldn't think that you're going to get out the quantum result without taking care of that entanglement you've left in your system. Yeah? So, but, you know, if Dan was here, I think he would say it's all in there, right? Look at the properties of the gates, understand the correlation of the errors, you're good. Parallel quantum error correction. Only trivial examples of it have been shown. And this is very hard to do without creating correlated errors today. And of course, distant gates. So gates between distant qubits. So, yeah.
Are you looking at physical separation, possibly across other qubits within the same setup?
So I'm looking at a separation in terms of the interconnectivity of the Hamiltonians. So it most likely is physical as well. But it's a really good question, and it's unfortunately one which I don't think we've given ourselves the tools yet to analyze. And you know, from your point of view, you might think, quantum mechanics, it looks like it's very well developed, which it is, and it's static. You know, from my point of view, the density matrix was only described within my lifetime. And okay, I wasn't paying attention to it when it was described. But you know, it's not such a distant concept. The ideas of open quantum systems, you know, Joseph Emerson is still trying to write the first book on that. And certainly we have some ideas, but we haven't put them all together. You know, for quantum information, John Watrous's new book or Dan's new book on quantum error correction. Right, these are such new fields that we're only still developing the tools, even though, you know, quantum mechanics itself we know and believe quite well. And so here's my attempt to answer your question, is to say, look, if I have a set of nodes that surrounding each of these control elements, there'll be a set of qubits. And those we can control well. And I'm going to think about them as local because their actuator's right there. It's going to hit them all. But somewhere over here, there's going to be another set. And normally we would think that these pieces are coupled. You know, there may be a cavity, it may be a dipolar field, it may be an electron that I'm sending there. But these pieces are coupled, and so there's a Hamiltonian underlying this, there's Hamiltonians underlying that, and everything's good. But if I try to write a Hamiltonian from a qubit here to a qubit there, it would have amplitude zero. And so I need to bring in some other system so that this processor interacting with this new system gives me an effective Hamiltonian over that part. And so it's going to show up, and we'll look at that next week. It'll show up as a commutator of a commutator of a commutator, right? So it'll be some nested sets of commutators. But this is what I mean by a distant gate. That there isn't some Hamiltonian directly I can build the system on. And it's a very active area of research. And there's it's a challenging piece because this part, if I describe it as a quantum system, I say, well, that's a qubit. Well, it's really easy to get your mind around it. But there was no reason for this to be a qubit. This could be a mesoscopic system. And all we're asking is that before and after the processor, it's left in a state which has overlap one, right? It's left in the same place. We haven't left any information there. And So we try to think about the dynamics of that, and it could be Klaus Mohner's has been looking at using magnons in metals, you know, something which we wouldn't think of as coherent, but can allow a coherent exchange of information. Miriam in my lab has been looking at collections of spin systems. An old problem in physics is to look at macroscopic quantum coherence, Tony Leggett's old ideas, old and current. So this is a rich physics, but it's of course inherently multi-body, and so it becomes challenging to prove something and to suggest an experiment where you could actually reveal it. Yeah. So I want there to be a way that I can create entanglement between any pair of qubits in the computational space. So if I think about, you know, my qubit here, and in this cloud of qubits, there's a qubit here. I want to create entanglement between those. Now, it might be that I have to take that qubit, entangle this control, take that control, and do something there, right? So it may be that the direct interaction between those two is zilch. But by some process, I need to be able to create entanglement. So if you start off in David DiVincenzo's model of saying you've prepared the system in a ground state that's fiducial, so 0, 0, 0 state, then if you can say that you can, if you can show that you can create entanglement between any random sets of qubits, you're good. Other questions?
It's like a pyramid, right? Because you've got your control, you've got your actual qubits, and then you've got one kind of set of control and a bunch of these control things, and you want the other links, those guys together.
Yeah.
But then once you do that, still you're gonna wind up with, you know, like 9 plaquettes sitting next to each other, and you can run around between these guys if you really now want to go from this one to the.
So, you know, it's maybe revealing that you say it's like a pyramid in showing some of the complexity, because, you know, you say, oh, I want to have this action of these multiple layers so I can connect to different length scales. But today we're going to insist that you do it in 2 dimensions. And so, you know, one of the results of quantum information theory is that you can't have a quantum computer in 1 dimension. Okay? Pound the table on that. No 1-dimensional quantum computers. You can't have a 1-dimensional ion trap and have a quantum computer. And no one is trying to do that. Okay? So by many clever ways, they make their ion trap effectively dimension greater than 1. And they do that by moving ions around and shuttling them. They also, of course, do it by having a set of nodes just like this. But I don't think that there's a proof that you can do quantum error correction in 2 dimensions. Do you know that? Okay, I couldn't point you to a proof. It seems likely. And it's again a place where if I wanted the last word, I would ask Dan, because, you know, that's his life. He knows it perfectly. No. I said, I didn't know of a proof that you could do quantum error correction in 2D. I think it's very likely that you can. But I don't know of a proof of that. Hard to prove some things in these fields. Yeah? Okay. So now then, let's keep going. So I want to finish a few pieces. And the last piece that we left with the Bloch equations is we showed that we could measure everything in the Bloch equations accept purity, so that when we allow the spin system to cool, well, it would cool to some level, because we were, but since we were always measuring the difference in populations, we don't directly get access to the purity. And Holger asked a question afterwards. He says, well, why don't you just make a strong projective measurement? But of course, every measurement comes with noise. So that's a nice way to do it, except in the presence of noise, it still doesn't answer your question. And the way that does answer your question is to say, let's take two qubits and let's use one qubit as an interferometer to let me know about the existence of the second qubit. So it's a really, it's a one qubit experiment. I'm going to use one qubit to learn about the other one. And I'm going to take a Hamiltonian. It doesn't matter too much what the Hamiltonian is. But it does matter that there is some coupling between the qubits, right? The qubits don't talk to each other, then looking at one isn't going to tell you anything about the other one, right? So this is how they talk. And there's, in general, three different ways of coupling two spin one-half particles. And they're usually written this way. You can write them any way you like. But this is equivalent to that operation. So it's that's why we write it in that structure. Okay. So now I have my energy level diagram. And I'm going to imagine for now that just the two lowest energy levels are populated. It doesn't make any difference what, we could put any temperature we want in here and do this. But this just keeps the conversation simple. And it's useful that I would label the energy of the transitions. And of course, here, the energy of this transition corresponds to the energy it takes to flip the second spin conditional on the first spin being up. And so the energy to flip the second spin is omega 2. And conditional on the first spin being up, it says that we're going to add half of that coupling term. And here, we're going to see that it's split the other way. And so we can write all of these down. So we have these four unique frequencies in the system. All right. And so the equilibrium state I've given here is just that. And of course, then therefore I can expand this out here. And if I multiply everything out, yeah. Here? Because it's a spin one half particle. Yeah, it's okay. Not sure why I split those two. But it doesn't make any bloody difference, is the correct answer. Okay, so we have this equilibrium state, and the experiment is simple enough. It says, let's take and rotate one of the spins, and just one, right? So I'm going to do a Ramsey fringe on qubit one. So corresponds to giving an X, well, let's say a Y pulse just to make the whole thing easier. So we have sigma X1 on the first one and plus 1 minus 2P sigma X1 sigma Z2. And of course, this thing is left in its eigenstate, so nothing's going to happen to it. I'm just going to drop it for now. Now I get to, yeah, I am. You're exactly right. It doesn't belong there. The problem with doing things on the board, I see two fours and say, oh, yeah. So now then, we've got these two terms. We can look at how they evolve. This one, of course, evolves into Y under that Hamiltonian. So it's going to evolve into sigma Y. This term is going to evolve into sigma Y sigma Z. So that's that piece of the Hamiltonian. And of course, under this bilinear term, sigma X is going to evolve into sigma Y sigma Z. And sigma X, sigma Z is going to evolve into sigma Y. Okay? And so if I write out the total evolution, I'll get the term that looks like 2 minus 2P. We can all forget that. 1 minus P. Sigma X1 E plus. And I'll get the term that looks like sigma x1, and it comes in as p, e minus. And this term shows up with a frequency of omega 1 plus omega c over 2. This one shows up at a frequency of omega 1 minus omega c over 2. So all I need to do is collect this signal as a function of time in a Ramsey fringe, and I'll see two resonances. And by measuring their difference in amplitude, I directly measure the purity. So with one additional spin, we can measure the purity. And so now we've measured everything in the Bloch equation. And so then we're good. We don't have to, we can fulfill David DiVincenzo's requirement that we have well-characterized qubits. Okay, I want to show you two more things. I'm going to skip a piece of the lecture and come back to it. Come on. Thank you. The first piece I want to show you is a piece that Holger's going to talk about more on Monday. And that's to say, I want the gates to work in the presence of noise. So if I have a gate, and let's say I want to do a pi rotation about x. And so then I would say, I'm going to apply a field here, and it's going to go down to 2x. But if I have noise that says that the time I've set that pulse or the power of that pulse is not perfect, then instead of showing up here, I'm going to show up at some range of locations. And this piece, this error, is there. It's constant in time. There's no reason we should put up with that. And so what people have said is, well, why don't you do this instead? Make a pulse which is more complicated, but gets you closer to the answer that you want. And you can see how this would work, that if your first pulse of 90 degrees takes you not quite 90 degrees, then the rotation about the y-axis will take you closer. It'll make up some of that error, but you'll still have an error in this. And then when you come here, you'll get closer than you would have if you just added those two, right? And it's easy to see the result of that. Well, you always have relaxation in your system. So you're going to have to fight those errors as well. And if I have just one qubit in unitary control, then one qubit by itself with unitary control isn't going to do anything to fight noise that's purely Markovian. Okay? If I want to fight that noise, and I can, I need another qubit. So here, I just want to motivate that in terms of simple error models, we can, in fact, make gates that are more robust. And here I just show you what the trajectory looks like. You can see that the errors in getting towards minus z are still there, but they're smaller than they would have been otherwise. And we can look at the projection. So this curve is the ideal curve, of course, starting from m sub z of plus 1 with the desired action of going to minus 1. You can see that the bottom is flatter. And Holger's going to show you that you can do this over a wider range of interesting errors, and that you don't need to guess the answer and then compute it, that you can find a general answer without having to guess.
So,
yeah.
You can, I mean, you've replaced the pi on x rotation,
and that's where the error sources, right?
So I've replaced this with this.
Your pi on twos are like off
by. Oh, okay.
Then it will.
Let me. I'm not cheating on you, man. What I'm simulating is that.
Yeah. I'm wondering. I mean, the point is that like the pi on two, the epsilon in the rotation around the x direction, that error is getting cancelled.
So this thing is an effective rotation that's pi minus alpha. It's actually, calculate this, it's actually not that, but it looks like it is. This error is smaller than this.
Yeah, I was saying, I think if you just like split that pi rotation up in the y direction, and you kind of like, you know, you do this trick where you rotate by pi on 2,
mm-hmm.
and then, you know, rotate by, say, I think you probably do it in the z direction. Oh, no, you might want to do it.
Oh, you're saying that you can keep doing this process and get better and better. Oh, absolutely. So, yeah, those pieces, there's a whole hierarchy of so-called composite pulses that get you there. You know, it tends to be that every time you want to go to the next order, you're going to double the length of your sequence. And there are more clever ways of doing that. You're building in a lot of redundancy that you don't need to have in the system. But it is one of the ways that's used. Optimal control theory that says, let me just find some robust pulse, even though it doesn't have some nice intuitive understanding. And you know, there are moments where imposing that you have an intuition about how some complicated process works limits your solutions too much.
If you're designing like a complicated pulse like that, is there some point where the error you get just from putting in additional gates kind of cancels out
when we design these pulses, we can analyze them for the errors that the pulses themselves have. And we can show that we can build a sequence which is going to, as part of its complexity, suppress the errors that we expect to be there. So for instance, if I'm applying a rotation, it's in fact not the case that they're turned on instantaneously, right? So there's, you know, it's certainly not adiabatic, but there's some reactance, and so you turn on and then there's a smooth term, right? It's like going through a filter, and so you can build all that in. It does burden you. It says, oh, you need to know what the errors are in your electronics. And the word error there is a little bit misleading because, you know, normally we're applying a field. And so the fact that what you're using to apply a field would have inductance isn't an error. It's the way you get a field, is by having inductance. And so if you analyzed it as a resistor instead of an inductor, you know, it's hard to call that an error of the equipment, right? It's an error of the designer. Okay, I think with those questions, we better stop, because if I start this other one, I'll never get far enough into it to actually explain what I want to explain. So we'll continue next week. Any other questions? Yeah, please.
I had a question. So you earlier spoke about asking the question whether we want a general purpose quantum computer, and had a question along those lines. So say in the classical case, we can scale computing up a number of levels up till we get to a general purpose classical computer. So we could start with hardwired circuits that solve specific tasks. Then we can start putting in registers to give some level of control on, say we want the circuit to perform one task at one time and another task at another time. Then as we progress further, we could add more registers and then put in programs and the abilities to remove and reprogram the circuit and so on. So are there any general discussions on an analogous process in developing a quantum computer?
There's a lot of literature on architectures. I don't think that there's general design rules. And at the moment, because we don't have enough experience with those points, it's hard to say. The piece I was going to show you, and I will show you next week, is to take a small quantum processor and to convert it into a simulator to look at the harmonic oscillator. And so it gets to your point. It says, yeah, I can take one physical system and I can make it look like it's another physical system. And I can use that as an analog of having that physical system. And so I can, you know, turn some knobs, test what the how the system I wish to simulate would work if I had it in the lab. And then you might say, well, if you can do that, well, you know what the qubits you want are. Why don't you just use your simulator to generate the qubits you want for your quantum computer? And the challenge is errors. That in a model of a quantum computer, we've developed ideas of fault tolerance, but those ideas don't carry over to a quantum simulator. And so we don't know how to impose the fault tolerant aspects in that. So you know, it's a good place to think if there's some intuition to be gained and some advantage. But it's so early in the field that I don't have the answer to it. Other questions? Then we'll stop here. Thanks.